Morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Timothy Dutter on behalf of plaintiff below, appellant Peter Feldman. Count 13, the only claim at issue in this appeal, alleges that the directors of Telex breached their fiduciary duties to Telex's stockholders in the context of a merger by failing to consider the issue of whether a significant number of options were valid, and as a result of that failure, Telex's stockholders were harmed because they did not receive a proper allocation of consideration in that merger. These allegations relating to the merger that are contained in the operative complaint are based upon discovery that plaintiff received during the course of the litigation. The options at issue were the subject of a complaint in this action that was filed while the merger was being considered and negotiated, and the complaint that the Telex directors were presented with at the time they were considering this merger alleged that the options at issue had never been disclosed to the stockholders, even in connection with a stockholder meeting where the stock option plan was presented to the stockholders for their approval. It also alleged that there was not a single contemporaneous document relating to the existence of these options. And the complaint also alleged that the existence of these options had not only been hidden from the company's stockholders, but had been concealed from plaintiff by the provision of a false document in a prior Section 220 action. Now, as alleged in Count 13, when faced with these allegations, the Telex directors did nothing. The merger proceeded to closing, the merger proceeds were allocated, and the holders of those invalid options went on to receive $16 million of merger consideration that should have been instead received by the company's other stockholders.
And what was the board asked to do? You said they did nothing. What was the request for them to do?
In terms of, was there a demand on the board? There was no demand at the time this complaint was filed in this action. The board was considering the merger, but this litigation was already ongoing at that time. And so when the second amended complaint was filed, there was no demand made upon the board by plaintiff, at least. The allegation is that the
right. So in the absence of a demand, what is it that you expected the board to do?
Well, what we expected the board to do was they clearly had notice of the complaint. I'm sure that they received a copy of it and reviewed it. And what would be expected of a board in that position while they are in the midst of negotiating and considering a merger, which we weren't actually aware of at the time, plaintiff wasn't aware at the time, is to at least do something with respect to these options that were alleged to be invalid for numerous reasons.
Give me an example. Are you suggesting that the board should have brought an action on behalf of the corporation to invalidate the options?
No, Your Honor. What I would believe that there were numerous options available to the board, one of which would be to form a special committee to investigate the issue and make a recommendation to the board with respect to the options. Another one might have been to...
But ultimately, at the end of the day, I want you to give me an example of what should be done. Your client contends that they got less money because the options, became stock. The stock was available at the time of the merger. If the stock hadn't been out there, they would have gotten more money. And therefore, there seems to be a suggestion in your argument that the board should have made sure the options weren't converted into stock before the merger went through. Now, how did you want the board to accomplish that, what your client asked?
Well, in addition to the procedures that I just mentioned, I think that at the end of the day, if the board determined or received an opinion or determined on its own by recommendation from a special committee that the options were in fact invalid, they could have taken over the negotiation of the merger and simply not provided for their receipt of merger consideration in the merger agreement. I don't know that they necessarily...
So you're saying the board could have unilaterally said, we're not going to recognize the options?
Yes.
And to the extent they wanted to do that in a legal context, it would have been an action by the corporation saying the options are not valid, which brings us to the underlying theme in this case. Is your client's claim direct or derivative?
Right. Well, I don't know that the corporation would have had to pursue any sort of legal action. They had the power to simply change the merger so that the board of directors, as a matter of fact, had the power to change the merger agreement so that it did not provide for consideration to invalid option holders.
Don't you think the option holders would have said, well, you can't do that?
Oh, I'm sure that they would have. I'm sure that they would have, Your Honor. Now, there are two arguments on this appeal. The first argument is our argument, as we've discussed a little bit already, that the court's decision below ought to be reversed based upon this court's decision in Thule. Now, the second argument is one that the defendants have attempted to insert in this appeal, that the court below's decision can be affirmed on an alternative holding on business judgment rule grounds. Now, we've briefed this issue. I think it's fairly clear that the court's decision below didn't make an alternative finding on business judgment rule grounds. The defendants, in making this argument, are relying on a footnote, the first sentence of which says that the court is not making a decision on business judgment rule grounds. As we've also argued, that shouldn't be surprising, given that the defendants never raised that argument in their opening brief. And under Supreme Court Rule 8, we would submit that it's not an argument that is properly a part of this appeal and doesn't need to be considered by the court.
You would agree that the Vice Chancellor had Thule in mind when he decided that your claims were derivative and not direct and dismissed them?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
And where did he go wrong with the two prongs of Thule that he's supposed to examine?
Well, I think one of the main ways that the Vice Chancellor erred in his application of Thule.
Why don't you remind us of the two prongs of Thule and then tell us as to each where he went wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. The decision in Thule says that in determining whether a claim is derivative or direct, that analysis is to be based solely on two questions. The first question is, who suffered the alleged harm? And the second question is, who would receive the benefit of any recovery from the claim at issue? Now, the first prong, I would submit just generally, one of the ways that the court below did err in its application of Thule is it never reached the second prong. It only applied the first prong. And I know that the defendants have argued in their brief that if the answer to either of those two questions is the corporation, then the claim at issue is derivative. Now, Thule doesn't say that, and I would note that there's no citation to any authority for that position in the appellee's brief, and I think that the reason
if there's no harm to a party, why would you get to the second prong?
Well,
the second prong addresses the remedy that would be available in the event harm was done to the party.
Well,
so why would the Vice Chancellor be wrong in saying, as I address the first prong of Thule, I conclude that the only harm that was suffered here was to the corporation itself and not to the individual stockholders, therefore this is a derivative claim, end of story. Why doesn't that logically follow from Thule?
Well, Your Honor, let me just back up. I think first, we think that the Vice Chancellor didn't apply the first prong correctly either.
Well, then why don't you address that? And then
sure.
We'll worry about whether the second prong is an issue or not.
Sure. Now, taking the first prong of this exclusive test in Thule, the question is who suffered the alleged harm? The case law interpreting Thule tells us that the court looks at the nature of the harm, of the alleged harm, and the duty that's implicated. As we've argued in our brief, count 13 implicates the duty of directors of Delaware corporations to ensure that their stockholders receive fair consideration in mergers. That's the duty that's at issue. And as count 13 alleges, the directors breach that duty by failing to consider whether these options that are at issue were valid and should therefore receive merger consideration. And by breaching that duty, they breach their duty to the stockholders to receive the proper allocation of that merger consideration.
Now, that's a factual duty. Which actual fiduciary duty are we talking about? Loyalty or care?
I believe it would be the fiduciary duty of loyalty is where fairness claims arise, okay. is my understanding of the case law. Now, the Vice Chancellor...
Staying with this Thule analysis, your opponents put a lot of reliance on the Kramer case,
yes.
which was a special injury case decided before Thule, but they say notwithstanding the special injury aspect of Kramer, Kramer survives our pronouncement in Thule. It's still good law, and it's indistinguishable from this case. What's your reaction to their Kramer argument?
Well, first, I agree that Kramer does survive. Thule specifically says that Kramer is still good law, notwithstanding, as Your Honor said, the special injury aspect of it. The difference between this case and Kramer is in Kramer, the plaintiffs there, they didn't even, they conceded that their argument was simply that the transactions that happened, it was, the granting of some golden parachute type payments 6 months before the merger at issue. The plaintiffs there conceded that was the harm. That's when the harm occurred 6 months before, and all they did was bring that claim forward to allege that because that harm that occurred was wrong, the entity as a whole in the merger was undervalued, and that was the genesis of their unfairness claim. Now, the difference between Kramer and this case is, number one, we do allege a claim arising directly out of the merger that...
Well, you do, but that's why I brought up Kramer, because if you look at the end of the Kramer opinion, it talks about two things. One is the special injury that we'll put that aside. But the other point Kramer makes is you can't take what is otherwise a derivative claim and turn it into a direct attack on the merger. And that seems to be exactly what your clients are doing.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that analysis. And I think the reason why our case is different from Kramer's because in that case, there was what that case stands for is that your allegations, the plaintiff's allegations arising out of the merger, have to be such that it actually affected the fairness of the merger. And in that case and in other cases that preceded it and followed it, the concern was that there was a lack of allegations when you're talking about a challenge to the entire price that the entity receives in a merger. There is a lack of allegations tying the wrong that you've alleged to some reduction in that price when the merger actually goes through. And in our case, we have a different situation because we do not challenge the $213 million that was received, was offered, and was paid for the entity as a whole. Our allegations are that the fairness of the merger was affected in its allocation. And we know from no cases in this court, but certainly in the Chafin case in the court below and others that, and I think in Oliver and other cases, that still constitutes a challenge to the fairness of a merger. And that is how our case is different, I believe, from Kramer and why it states a claim directly arising out of and attacking the fairness of this merger. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd...
Well, I have another question. Let's assume for a moment that Feldman prevailed on his claim that the options to the directors were invalid. When the corporation reclaimed the portion of the merger proceeds that went to those individuals, what would happen to them?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that that's what we're asking to have done here. I know that the appellees argue that in their brief. What we're seeking is not a reallocation of the merger proceeds. What we're seeking is damages from the directors that would certainly be measured by what the other stockholders ought to have received and would have received, but for the inclusion of the invalid options in the merger consideration. And so...
And that money would go where?
To the stockholders that were shortchanged.
So you're not asking for anyone to recover any money from the holders of what you characterize as the invalid options. They can keep their money. And what you want to do is recover from this new board because they were on notice that they're invalid options, they approved the merger anyway, and they breached their fiduciary duty by permitting it to go forward.
I think that's a fair characterization of our claim, Your Honor.
And why do you characterize that fiduciary duty breach as loyalty rather than carelessness?
Because it implicates the duty of the board at the time they were considering and approving the merger to ensure that fair consideration in the merger goes to those who it properly should.
Okay, do you want to save the balance of your time?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I represent the defendants today, the appellees in this matter. Your Honor, the issue before the court, Your Honors, the issue before the court is whether count 13 is a derivative claim or a direct claim. If it is a derivative claim, the settled law in this court, right, in Lewis versus Anderson, which was upheld by the same panel 4 years ago in Lewis versus Ward, right, states that it is eliminated in the merger unless there's fraud or unless it's mere reshuffling of form, neither of which occurred here. Here. In the Kramer versus Western Pacific case, this court—
When you say neither of which occurred here, it's neither of which is claimed here, even. Isn't that correct?
There was a claim below that the court should create a new exception in Lewis versus Anderson. That is not pursued on appeal. So Your Honor is right. It is not claimed we have fraud here or mere reshuffling. In fact, it is clear to everybody that somebody paid over $200 million for the corporation. It was a real merger for real business purposes.
So we're not focusing on any exceptions. We're simply focusing on count 13, and the only issue is it direct or derivative?
Yes. And, Your Honor, that gets us to the Thule case, where this court clarified the law and I think helped create a unified theory of derivative suits in Delaware. And Thule says, to whom did the harm happen and who gets the remedy, if there is a remedy? The settled law in this court and every other one that I know of, given the segregation between the corporation and the shareholders, is a claim that options were wrongfully issued, is a claim that belongs to the corporation because it is a claim for waste. The essential element of it is the company did not receive what it should have. It didn't get the benefit of its bargain. In this case, the appellant says, these options should never have been granted, and in fact, probably were never lawfully granted. And under those circumstances, they say that the company should not, the options should have been returned into the company.
Well, in trying to avoid having their claim characterized as derivative in an effort to make it direct, what your opponent is saying is that this board of directors, the new board, was on notice that the options were invalid. To that extent, the new board was on notice that the corporation had a claim. And notwithstanding notice that the corporation had a claim, the merger went forward. Therefore, they hurt me individually. And my claim now is direct against the board because they disregarded this claim the corporation had. Now, as I understand your position, that argument is similar to the one that was addressed and rejected in Kramer.
It is almost identical to the one addressed and rejected in Kramer. They have twisted the argument in Kramer just a bit and said the board had a duty on the day they were looking at the merger agreement to say, but we should throw out the options. And that's slightly different from Kramer. But if this court, and I have two responses to why it's wrong. The first is what would happen. And if this court said, well, that's correct, and you can change a derivative claim into a direct claim that way, Lewis versus Anderson would be eviscerated because every single derivative claim, bar none, would require the same kind of consideration. Every derivative claim says the company was shortchanged in the past as we're being shortchanged in the merger because we either don't get our pro rata part of the property or there's too many shares of stock out there. It would happen in every single case. Lewis versus Anderson and would still be good law. I don't think Kramer would. Lewis would be, but it wouldn't never. It would never come up because there would be a new claim created. The second problem, and the deeper one, is what is wrong with plaintiff's claim? And what's wrong with it is it misunderstands what Delaware law does to these claims. A derivative claim belongs to the corporation. This claim of bad option grants belonged to Telex. On the merger, it passed to the new owner of Telex, GI Partners. That is, now, I believe, in fact, that the claim is now barred by the statute of limitations. Putting that aside, the new owner of Telex had the right to pursue this claim. That is what Lewis teaches us. That is, in fact, what this panel said in Lewis versus Ward 4 years ago. It passes to the new corporation. And so if the new corporation wants to bring the claim, they can. What the shareholders are entitled to in the merger is not to pursue this claim. They're entitled to fair value for their stock, for their shares. If they don't get fair value for their shares in a cash-out merger like this, they're entitled to bring an appraisal claim. The value that this claim had, we say it actually had none, that management did an awfully good job, and you can see by the growth in the stock price how good a job they did, and I think most of the stockholders would say so, but assume this is a valid claim. And assume GI Partners didn't pay enough in the merger for this claim. In which case, Mr. Feldman, with his 1,000 shares, could pursue an appraisal claim and say, I deserve more. And that's what the remedy Delaware supplies. Now, there are cases, of course, where appraisal is not available, typically a stock-for-stock merger where you get publicly traded stock. And this court in Lewis versus Ward said what the remedy for a stockholder was there. If you are a stockholder in the new company, you've got the stock, and the new board doesn't do anything, you can, under the right circumstances, bring a double derivative claim. Now, that doesn't apply here, but that's what Lewis versus Ward says, as it suggested. Now, that has to be done under the Rails standard. Tests have to be met. But that is the remedy for stockholders. The remedy here for this lack of value was an appraisal. It is not to take a corporate asset, and it's undeniable this is a corporate asset. This claim, Claim 13, was brought in three or four other accounts of the complaint as specifically a derivative claim. And Count 13 said, but it changed on the date of the merger. The law of Delaware is a derivative claim does not change on the date of the merger into a direct claim. It stays as a claim of the surviving corporation. The new party gets it. And in here, a stockholder who thinks it's worth a lot of money can bring an appraisal action. That is how our law works. That's why Kramer is right. That is why Lewis versus Anderson is right. Lewis versus Ward is right. And that is why the Court of Chancery was correct below. Unless the court has any questions, that's all I have.
You're content to leave the second argument on the briefs?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
I just have a couple of points to respond to. I believe counsel began his argument making somewhat of a policy argument that essentially every plaintiff that has a derivative case can do exactly what we did here and turn it into a direct claim. And I would respectfully disagree with that. I think that a review of the complaint that is the operative complaint demonstrates that it is not your typical complaint. It's based on discovery. It's highly detailed. It is it attaches documents, and I don't think that any stockholder that has a derivative claim can come in and make the allegations that we've made of unfairness arising out of the merger and simply turn a derivative claim into a direct claim.
I don't think the Vice Chancellor found that your factual allegations were inadequate or incomplete. He didn't consider it a not well-pled claim. He just found that based on the facts that supported your claim, it was a derivative and not a direct claim, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I understand that, and that is our argument, that he did not reach that sort of analysis of our complaint either. But my point is more that what we have done is we have come in and we have alleged a direct claim arising out of the merger based upon the facts that I discussed earlier, that these directors were presented with, put on notice of the invalidity of these options, and in response they did nothing. I don't think that that's the type of allegation that any plaintiff that has a derivative claim can come in and just make, at least not on a good faith basis. And the other point that counsel made is that the new owner of Telex had a right to pursue the claim of the invalidity of the options. I think the problem with that argument is twofold. One is that's not the claim that we're pursuing. We are not standing here saying the options were invalid, therefore there were damages. I've probably said this too many times today, but we have alleged a separate, distinct claim that arises out of the merger that affects its fairness. We are not standing here, and our complaint does not simply say, as the plaintiff, I believe, in Kramer did, and I think to a certain extent the plaintiff in the J.P. Morgan case said, which is, this is what happened months before, and it affected me later, and therefore I'm entitled to damages. We have a separate claim. And finally, counsel mentioned the appraisal remedy. I thought that what he seemed to be arguing was that it's the exclusive remedy in this type of a situation. I don't think that there's any authority for that, and I didn't hear any cited, and there's certainly none cited in the brief. Plaintiff here is not relegated to an appraisal remedy for the allegations that he's made and is entitled to bring a breach of fiduciary duty action and receive damages. Unless the court has any further questions,
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel will take your submissions on recess and adjourn.